we are just now at the end of September. It's the last Sunday of September. And I walked in Lowe's the other day and saw Christmas supplies. We live in a culture that goes crazy commercially over all these holidays, whether it be Valentine's or July the 4th or Easter or Halloween, Thanksgiving, and then, of course, Christmas. And one of the things that happens because we jump so fast into the celebration of Christmas so quickly is we don't pause to consider what the Christian church calls Advent. And we're right on the verge of Advent starting in the month of December. Advent typically runs from right at the end of November sometimes all the way through the day before Christmas. And Advent is that period of time that leads up to Christmas. And when we get to Advent this year, we'll perhaps sing O Come, O Come, Emmanuel, one of the classic Advent songs. And in that classic Advent song, you'll hear the notes of the longing to know and see Jesus. O come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel that mourns in lonely exile here until the Son of God appear. Advent means to come to. You have the first advent of Jesus when he was born and lived in this world, and then you have the second advent that we're focusing on here in Thessalonians. And so whenever Advent season comes along, Advent season is supposed to be a season of anticipation, of waiting, of wanting the day of Christmas to come, and the anticipation of Christ's coming, not just his first coming, but his second coming, as well as the times that he comes to us here in our worship services, or as he comes to us daily in our life. And that whole theme of Advent, and you can see it in the song, O Come, Emmanuel, is the longing and the waiting for the day when Emmanuel shall come to his people. Now, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 13 through chapter 5, verse 11, Paul is focusing on that theme, the second advent of Christ, that Christ has come, but he will come again. And as we await that second coming, he gives us hope in the face of our trials as we wait for him. Now, as we move into this section of Thessalonians to talk about the second coming, we do have to give a word of caution. And ironically enough, things in the Middle East tend to explode frequently. And just this past week, not only did we face a terrible natural disaster with the hurricane that ripped through the Gulf and then up through the state of Georgia and devastated things in Georgia and North South Carolina and Tennessee, but you have Israel attacking Lebanon this past week. And so you have these tensions that happen over there. I remember growing up in a church that had prophecy conferences. And they would talk about how whenever something happens in the Middle East, it's a sign of the times. And so most of our prophecy conferences were all about figuring out when Jesus was going to come back based on what was happening in the Middle East. And I specifically remember sometime in 89 or 90, I don't remember exactly when, but I was riding down the road with my mother as the radio was breaking the news that President Bush decided to start the Gulf War and move on the countries in that area and on Saddam Hussein in particular. And I remember in the church that I grew up in, everybody started pointing to a book by John Walvoord, who was a Bible prophecy professor over in Texas, that was titled Armageddon Oil and the Middle East Crisis, that was released in 1990. And in that, it describes how Dr. Walvoord was recognized as the father of modern biblical prophecy because it seems like his predictions are always coming true with the establishment of the nation of Israel. And if Israel's established, then this happens and that happens in biblical prophecy. All this stuff is part of a whole group of beliefs that you know of more popularly through the Left Behind series. We call it theologically dispensationalism. As I wrestled with this in the 90s, I realized that that book that was re-released in 1990 was actually released in 1974, 15 years earlier, with the same emphasis that the Middle East was about to explode and Jesus was about to come back. And what I remember reading as I studied this is that that whole notion of when the nation of Israel was established and as it is established that by the time that generation that saw it dies, Jesus will come back. And I thought, well, Jesus come back in my lifetime. I'm not even going to make it to an old age. And now I'm sitting here 40 years later, and didn't happen. So one of the things we have to be cautious about is all of the excitement and emphasis that happens in some of these books about reading the newspaper and figuring out what the Bible's saying based on that. That is not the way Paul does it. And it's not the way we do it typically as Presbyterians, because our view of this is called covenantal. And so we try to understand what Paul's saying and how it helps us. And I remember how coming out of that, I got very frustrated with any study on the second coming of Christ. Like everywhere I turned, it felt like they were bombarding me with some kind of thing like this. Until I connected the second coming of Christ to Advent and the season of Advent. And that the season of Advent is a reminder that God keeps his promises. And that's ultimately what the second coming of Christ is about, the first and second coming. Not only what he's going to do, but God promised to send his son, and he did. And God promises again to send him and make all things new and wipe the tears from our eyes, and he will. And each year, the season of Advent is a season to remember that that is yet to come. And so, as we come to this point of Thessalonians, I want us to have about 6 points of overview. I'm just going to highlight 6 broad points from this section that we read to highlight how practical and important the second coming of Christ is, not in terms of figuring things out in the Middle East or anything, but what's it mean for your life today, right now, in whatever situation that you face. So first of all, the second advent of Christ gives hope. Verse 13, but we do not want you to be uninformed, brothers, about those who are asleep, that you may not grieve as others who have no hope. This is actually a very important statement. Let's put ourselves in the first century with these Christians. We're living only 20 years after, or so after the death, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus. You know what they were thinking. Jesus is going to come back soon. And we know from the New Testament that that was a struggle for some of them. And so perhaps they think they will see Jesus return. But then here's what happens. People start to die. So you're part of that first generation, the first 20 years, and then Christians start to die, and you start to go, uh-oh, what does this mean for us now? And this is why Paul says, we do not want you to be uninformed, brothers, about those who are asleep, those who have died, that you may not grieve as others who have no hope. Paul's saying 2 things there. First, he's saying that it's okay for Christians to grieve, that it's okay for that kind of process to happen. But secondly, he is also saying that we have hope. Out of that grief, there is a hope that this death does not have the last words. And so the ground of that hope is in verse 14. For since we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so, through Jesus, God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep. Now, that's what he was trying to assure them of, that they did not know how this was all going to wrap up. And Paul says those who have died are not going to miss this event. Those who are died are assured that God will protect them, fulfill his promise for them too. So he says, since we believe Jesus died and rose again, we also believe that those who have fallen asleep, who are dead now, will come with Jesus when he returns. And so Paul is highlighting for them that the second advent, when Christ comes, gives them hope. do not grieve in the midst of death as if you have no hope. Number two, the second advent of Christ also provides clarity, Paul says. This 14, verse 14 through 17. So he goes on that Jesus will bring with him those who have fallen asleep. Verse 15. For this we declare to you by a word from the Lord, that we who are alive, who are left until the coming of the Lord, will not precede those who have fallen asleep. So as you take this into consideration, the people sitting in Thessalonica are hearing, since we believe Jesus rose again from the dead, died and rose, Jesus will bring back those who have died with him. So God will take care of them. So it clarifies what happens to those who have died, which is a common concern in the early church. When we have the same concern, but we have all the New Testament. And Paul, imagine what it would be like if Paul had not provided these words. What would we believe about this? How would we think about the future? So Paul is saying, we have declared to you that we who are left until the coming of the Lord will not precede those who have fallen asleep. What good news that would have been to those Christians. That whether you have a loved one who is dead or they're still alive and you're alive with them, whatever is the case, God has a plan so that the dead in Christ seem to rise first, and then we'll join them in this moment when Christ wraps all things up. That brings a great deal of clarity about the second advent. It doesn't provide all the details, but the sequencing of events that Paul describes here becomes the basis of the hope for the church for years to come. Even now, your notion of that second coming is so wound up with what Paul describes right here. And so providing them that clarity is an important point of hope for these Christians. Number three, the second advent of Christ provides comfort. Look at verse 18. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a cry of command, with the voice of an archangel, and with the sound of the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so we will always be with the Lord. And here's verse 18. Therefore, encourage one another with these words. That word translated encourage in verse 18 is the word for exhort. That has led some to translate it as comfort in this particular passage, since we're dealing with the grief that you face when a loved one dies. And so Paul is saying, let these words comfort you. Let these words comfort and encourage you so that you might not be confused on this matter. And this is the reason why Paul explains the sequence of these events. He does not want them to be uninformed because he wants them and us to be comforted. His words are meant to strengthen our faith, to provide hope, and hope is the basis of the comfort Paul is highlighting. Sometimes we forget how influenced we've been by the gospel when we struggle for our faith with obedience and assurance. But we're so influenced by the gospel that almost every one of us here in this building live on the basis of hope because of what Christ has done. Listen to the way the pagans in Paul's time comforted one another in the face of death. There was a complete sense of hopelessness that is reflected by their statements. There is this one pagan in the Roman Empire, Theocritus, who says, hopes are for the living. The dead have no hope. Now, if you have a gospel message that comes into a culture that says there is no hope, and you're now saying there's hope on the basis of the gospel, it's transformative. Others point to a second century letter written by an Egyptian lady named Irene to a grieving couple as they face the death of their son. And after explaining they've done everything they can in these circumstances, she concludes her letter by saying this, "But nevertheless, against such things one can do nothing. Therefore, just comfort one another." She uses the same word Paul uses, comfort one another. But did you hear her language? She says, nevertheless, against such things, one can do nothing. And since you can't do anything, just help each other out. Whereas Paul says, since you know how this thing's going to go, comfort one another in what Christ has done. There's a depth of comfort and hope that Paul is giving to these Christians. The next point, the second advent of Christ should produce diligence in us. This comes from chapter 5, verses 1 through 7. There's something about the study of the second advent and what Paul's describing here that seems to describe that we should be diligent about our life. Paul describes the second coming in this chapter in two images: sudden labor pains of a pregnant woman and a thief. Both of these illustrations, both of these images, are moments when you're surprised or caught off guard. And so Paul is trying to highlight that you are not in darkness about the second coming. You're not going to be caught off guard. You're going to be aware that this is coming. You know it's coming. You do not need to know the specific times and seasons, he says. And he says, he goes so far as to say, so, verse 6, so then let us not sleep as others do, but let us keep awake and be sober. And so Paul is encouraging us to be the opposite of those who don't believe, who are asleep and not paying attention, but to be very sober and diligent in our life. Now, that points towards the behavior we're supposed to have simply because we know Christ is coming. If you turn back to just a moment to the passage in James chapter 5 that we read a moment ago, I want you to notice how James highlights this. After going through that in chapter 5, that opening section about the rich and how they are not prepared, he then moves in verses 7 through verse 12 or so about being patient in suffering. Now, that has been a common theme in Thessalonians. Remember? Paul shows up. He preaches the gospel. In Acts 17, it turns that culture in Thessalonica upside down, and Paul has to slip out by night, and the others go through a lot of suffering after Paul leaves. Now, watch what's being said right here about our suffering. Verse 7. Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. So James is also talking about the second coming. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until it receives the early and late rains. You also be patient. Now think about it. Around this area, there's a lot of farmland. A lot of farmland on the way driving here. There are crops out right now. Corn stalks, soy, cotton. And it's about that time to harvest them. And Paul is saying, or James is saying, be like the farmer that waits for the fruit of the earth. You are not in darkness about the coming of Christ. You know it's a promise. And you wait for it with diligence. And then he says, verse 8, you also be patient. So be diligent about this. Establish your hearts. Prepare yourself, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged, because the judge is standing at the door. And so James is saying the same thing Paul's saying. Be patient in the midst of your suffering. Pull yourself out of the suffering and pain that you're going through right now to another level and perspective so that you can see the big picture. And that whatever it is you're struggling with right now is not going to derail the big story of the kingdom of God. It may be terribly painful and difficult and emotionally hard. It may be physically hard and physically painful and difficult. But it is not bigger than God. And it will not derail God's promise to make all things right for you. And so he gives us an example, James does. Verse 10, as an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. So the prophets are one example. But the second example he gives right here is Job. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job and the purpose, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. Now think about the story of Job for just a moment. Not very long. That would be a whole other sermon. Think about how the story of Job starts out with Job having all this stuff. The most blessed man at the time, the book says, or something close to that. And then one catastrophe after another hits him. The loss of land, loss of family, the loss of people. Over and over, he gets plowed over by waves of suffering. And then after those first two chapters, where Job is still clinging to his faith and saying he's going to trust God, and everybody that's against him, he's like, I'm still trusting God. When you get to chapter 3, you go all the way through the book, almost to the end of the book, with other people saying, giving suggestions and advice for Job, which in my experience, when I'm suffering and people give suggestions, it usually makes me suffer more. So that happens to Job. And then Job goes through all that, and then you get to the end of the story. And the end of the story points out that God had a purpose and a plan all along. Job never knew why. He didn't know why this was happening. But you find out, right? At the very beginning, Satan comes to God and says, God says, have you considered my servant Job? He's more righteous than anyone. And what Satan says, oh, he's righteous and he loves you because of everything you've given him. And then everything's gone. And Job still loves the Lord. And the end of the book of Job, as James is highlighting, says, this is the purpose of the Lord. When James says he showed the purpose of the Lord in that statement, he's highlighting that God revealed the whole thing at the end, which is what God's going to do when Jesus comes back. And he'll wrap it up. He will not answer why right now. He's not giving you that promise. Stop asking why. Just trust that he knows what he's doing. And you be diligent and faithful. And follow him and love others. Next, the second advent of Christ brings salvation. So not only is it doing these other things we've talked about, hope and comfort and producing diligence in our life, but the second advent of Christ results in salvation. Verses 8 through 10 of chapter 5. Notice what Paul says. But since we belong to the day, let us be sober, having put on the breastplate of faith and love, and for a helmet, the hope of salvation. For God has not destined us for wrath, but to obtain salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, so that whether we are awake or asleep, we might live with him. Now here, the second advent of Christ is described as bringing the hope of salvation, not wrath. That when he comes, you do not, if you are a believer, you will not experience the wrath of God. Paul describes the Christian's life as having the breastplate of faith and of love, and the hope as the helmet of salvation. And what Paul is doing with these descriptions is preparing for us the way of life of the faithful. How we live out in faith, hope, and love. And so Paul is highlighting for us that at the end of this, when this is done, the second advent of Christ brings the completion of what we call salvation. And then finally, the most practical aspect as he wraps up this in verse 11 is that the second advent of Christ provides encouragement. Not only the comfort that we saw in verse 18 of chapter 4, but now he uses a different word. He uses the word, actual word, encouragement. So as he wraps it up, verse 11, therefore, encourage one another and build one another up just as you are doing. Whereas Paul was emphasizing comfort and consolation in the face of death in chapter 4, now he's emphasizing encouragement because some are faint-hearted. Some are struggling with the death of their loved ones. And in this context, Paul is seeking to build them up, to encourage the faint-hearted so that they might press on in their faith. I hope with these broad points, these broad 6 points from this section, you can see how utterly practical the second coming, the second advent of Christ can be. It's one of the reasons why that's so woven into Advent itself. The doctrine of the second advent of Christ is a doctrine that helps us live our faith. It is crucial that we affirm the second coming of Christ and that we are called to wait patiently for Jesus. And it's hard for us to do. We seldom have to wait patiently for anything anymore. You're going to leave here and go get something to eat that you can have very quickly, when in previous generations, 100, 200 years ago, it would take them a long time to make the kind of meal you're going to have. And everything in the culture leans against you to be patient. But at the heart of the Christian faith is patiently waiting on whatever God is going to do. And so we should pray, O come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel that mourns in lonely exile here until the Son of God appears. When he does, rejoice. Rejoice.